Hello, welcome to the Long Shot Leaders Podcast. I'm Michael Stein. My guest today is John Lear. John is a comedic performer, writer, producer, working in television, film, and theater. But you guys might remember him from the Geico commercial, the Caveman Guys. He was the lead on that, and it also got turned into a TV show. He now appears on Hulu on the show Quick Draw. He's got a nice long shot story, too. He has some valleys that he went through in order to find his way. He's a really interesting story, interesting person. Here is John Lear. All right. I'm here with John Lear, and we had fun talking in the pregame because we have some stuff to share in our background, some mutual friends. But I'm a fan because I saw, you know, I was like, man, I just love the Geico Caveman commercials. I'm a 2001 guy. I'm a gorilla guy. When I did Love Hollywood Style, I had a caveman in one of my vignettes. So I'm really happy to have you, John. I love your story because of the challenges in it. You're a stand-up comedian. You're an auteur. You're a raconteur, you know? So I want to, you know, that's kind of like I'm paraphrasing, but you are a raconteur, right? You would say you're a cover. Right. So let's get into like what built you and what made you, and let's get back to the beginning. You said you were a hillbilly.
Well, yeah, I'm from Kansas. So I come from a lot of hillbilly stock, you know, white trash. My family is all from a small town outside of Wichita, Kansas, called El Dorado, not El Dorado, El Dorado, which was an oil town that kind of dried up. And my parents met in El Dorado and then moved to Kansas City. So we were kind of the family that, you know, went to the big city in Kansas City from our crew.
What did mom and dad do for a living?
My dad was, he was like one of those guys who was early stages computers. He went to Pittsburgh College in Kansas and majored in math and physics. And one of his first jobs was like soldering circuits for the early IBM computers. And, you know, he just, you know, got into it. It was a summer job, but that sort of, he was part of the computer age, you know, and kind of looked the part, you know. He's gone now, but he had a, you know, nerd look, classic nerd look, short sleeve button shirts with a pocket protector. And
like Ed Harris, you know, and the right stuff.
Exactly.
Apollo 13.
He was very charming, but also very eccentric. My mother was a social worker. She's gone too, but was a hardcore activist, which in Kansas and Missouri during that time, crazy. So she was essentially a socialist. She was arrested many times for protests. I mean, just unheard of in Kansas. Yeah. Right. I have this great photo of her being arrested for crossing some picket line and just smile, because she just looked like a Midwestern sweet woman. But man, she had fire.
Okay, weird contrast. Mom's that. Dad's like an astronaut engineer with his pen sticking out of his short sleeve.
Yeah.
Okay, it's interesting. Yeah, that clash. What about you? How did this affect you in high school? What was your personality like? Did you want to be an actor then, or what was going on with you?
No, I didn't really. You know, when where I came from, being an actor wasn't really a thing. That wasn't really a job. I mean, a lot of my family referred to acting or theater as drammer. You know, the idea of making money pretending to be somebody else was, you know, just not heard of. And I was a good student. I was a little nerdy, but I got involved in, I always loved cracking people up and being the class clown. And I did some theater, but it wasn't really till I got into Northwestern outside of Chicago. And that kind of opened me up to, I was exposed to improv comedy, improvisation, and that sort of changed everything for me.
Did you do Second City?
Yeah, I was, I trained at Second City. Oh. I never was on the main stage. During the time of Second City was kind of going through a bad period in the 80s when I was in Chicago, the group I was with, we're not really fans of it. It was kind of, you know, very sketchy and sort of pretty sexist. And I kind of hooked up with a group of people who kind of wanted to do something a little differently. And that we were kind of part of those early days of improv that led to what's now referred to as long form, which was more of a theatrical show rather than sketches and games and things.
How do you go from Northwestern, what you're doing at Second City, at least, you know, practicing there, you know, honing, workshopping it. How do you go from that to you go to LA, obviously, you know?
And yeah.
How does that work?
I was with this theater company called Ed, E-D. we wanted to take improv kind of out of the cabaret, out of the clubs, and kind of see if it could stand as theater. And it was a group of like-minded people. We a lot of kind of at the time cutting edge things. It was like there were more women than men in the cast, which was like unheard of, you know. And that theater company ended up doing a two-person show that I was in, which was, it was all improvised. It was super fast. People really liked it. It was at the Organic Theater, David Mamet's theater. And it caught the attention of a talent scout from Fox Network named Eve Zerley, this gorgeous former model turned development exec. And she came out and saw us. And after a show, asked us if we wanted to come to LA and do a showcase. And we were like, yeah, because we were broke. And we came out to LA and did a showcase. And it did really well. It was something people hadn't really seen yet, that kind of style. And it ended up getting us signed at ICM and Three Arts. And we got what was then called a holding deal, where you got paid to basically do nothing. They don't really have these anymore, but they would lock you down to a deal where you couldn't do anything for any other studio or network, and they'd pay you. So
early 90s.
They paid me $15,000, which was more money than I had ever seen. And unfortunately, I was on drugs at the time, so it went right up my nose. It was a fabulous couple of months.
let's rewind a little bit then. How did that metastasize? How did that happen? You know, was that in high school or did it happen at, you know, when you're doing improv?
In high school, I started right around 15. I guess I started smoking and drinking. And in Kansas at the time, you could drink at 18. Yeah. You could drink 3-2 beer at 18. So, which meant that you could get into bars at 16. And so we would just, that was just kind of a part of my lifestyle. You know, everybody did. And weed, marijuana grew wild, you know, it was called K weed and you could just pull it off the side of the road and smoke it and Kagers and things like that. And I was pretty straight laced, but then high school kind of hit and I sort of started to get exposed to that, but I was still a really good student. So I was able to make it work. And even through college at Northwestern, I was a very good student, but I started exploring more and more and got into harder drugs, but it wasn't really a problem per se. I mean,
in Chicago or LA?
In Chicago.
Okay.
I was just, you know, drinking it, but I started using, you know, hallucinogens and, you know, exploring cocaine. There's a lot of cocaine around in the 80s, mid 80s. And, you know, Northwestern, a lot of rich kids. So they had a lot of money for coke. I definitely started to notice that I was different from other people in that I would continue going when other people would stop, and that I was, open. It, you know, there was definitely maybe a genetic component could be. I mean, my family I have a lot of alcoholism in my family. Mm-hmm. And then it towards the end of college, and when I started doing theater in Chicago, then it started to turn dark and started to get really, you know, where I was doing, you know, trying anything, heroin, anything I could find.
But you got this opportunity. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because, you know, there's a couple different, you know, relationship with drugs and comedians and, you know, even improv, you know, Pete Davidson talks about it, where he's like, you know, if I'm high, you know, then I feel like I could do, you know, maybe it's a different avenue of how I'm going to do my job. And if I do my job shitty, he's like, well, hi, man, I was high. You know, so it's kind of like you can't lose, according to him. What was your relationship like that about performing and being doing the shit?
you know, I definitely performed on drugs. I remember doing shows on LSD and cocaine and definitely alcohol. How do
you
do that
as an improv when you have to be in the moment and listening and then responding to what you're listening to?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not really, it's a natural thing. Improv is something that comes very, very naturally to me. Yeah. It's never been something that I've had to work hard at. It's been kind of just a gift. Yeah. And so it didn't matter. It was just something that just, I don't know how to explain it. It just always flowed. It always flowed. And it, but I really, for the most part, didn't enjoy performing under the influence. I really enjoyed being under the influence after I performed. Like there was such a high coming off of the stage that I would just continue that in terms of drug and alcoholic abuse. And then that all of that combined to sort of just be a part of my lifestyle. You know, we're living at night, we're night creatures, we're performing, we're very successful, maybe not financially in Chicago, but we're a known entity and, you know, getting good reviews and full houses. And, you know, it was kind of a, you know, I talk to musician friends and it seems like there's some crossover there where you're just, it's fun and it easily can get out of control. And it did.
So this explains it. And then you go into the deeper into the fire, you go to LA where there's a lot of that fun or a lot of that activity going on afterwards. So you're absolutely doing that. You get that 15 grand gets soaked up like cotton candy in a swimming pool. And then, you know, what happens after that?
Well, things were getting darker during that period. I was just able to kind of keep it going. And I was very unhappy. I wanted to make my own stuff. And I just didn't realize that at the time. And I really wanted to utilize improv as a core to what I wanted to make. I didn't know exactly how. This is before, you know, Curb Your Enthusiasm there wasn't a lot of it. I guess Reno 911 started at maybe then, but anyway, there wasn't a lot of that. So I kind of had to divide myself and into an actor and a writer, and I could do both, you know, but it just didn't fill that sort of hole. And I think separate from all of that, I was just an unhappy person who was sort of battling depression and self-medicating. And so here I am in LA, I've got a little money. There's a lot of drugs and alcohol, but I would have found them anyway. I certainly don't blame LA on that. And if anything, I started drinking and using by myself, you know, more and more because it just got in the way when I had to go to bars and go out with people and talk to them. I just wanted to essentially kill myself, but just not having the guts to do that. So, right. And that ended up in an arrest where I was under the influence, driving, possession of narcotics with intent to sell. I was under the influence of LSD when I was driving. You know, it was bad. It was it wasn't my first run in with the law, but it certainly was turned out to be the straw that broke the camel's back. You know, I was looking at some serious jail time, and I was working at this point. You know, I was making my living acting and writing, but you know, here I am in jail and my lawyer saying, look, you're probably going to do some time on this one. You know, you're going to go to prison. And I was scared. So I don't know why, but I finally woke up and to this day, I don't really know why it happened then, but it did. And I've been sober ever since. And that was 26 years ago.
Was able to get you out of it doing time, or did you have to do something?
Yes. Yes. Everything was dropped. All of the charges were dropped. The officer screwed up somehow on the search. He was a rookie, it turned out. And he screwed up and everything was dropped. Didn't even get it. No DUI, no parking ticket, nothing. And I don't know. At the time, I thought that kind of fueled my desire to stop. I was like, whoa, this is a sign, you know, but not really. I mean, the further I get away from it, the more I think, you know what? I was just graced. You know, that's the word I use, grace. I just somehow was given this gift of sobriety And, you know, since then I've really worked on it to keep it. And, but at the
time, was that the point where it stopped, you know, or the beginning of it?
Yeah, that was, it was a very big dramatic moment that somehow I was in a place where I kind of just had a moment of clarity where I just kind of was like, whoa, wait, stop. And something happened. And at the time I thought I had done it. At the time I thought, oh, I'm deciding to quit and I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired and I'm going to make my life better. And here I go, like a sort of self-help approach to it. But like I said, the further I've gotten from that, the less credence I give that theory. I think because I've seen friends who, you know, are in similar situations and it's not enough for them. And, you know, a lot of people now, you know, come to me and they say, you know, I've got a friend or a relative who has a problem and can you help them stop? And, you know, I know what they're asking, but the answer really is no, I can't make them stop. I don't know how to do that. Once they stop, I can tell them some stuff that maybe can help them stay. But that first moment, I can't explain it. You know,
they need to hit threshold like you did.
Could be. That's the big theory is like you hit bottom, but I'd hit bottom.
Yeah.
Plenty of times.
Well, yeah, but there's different stages that your bottom, you know, could have been the anal rape in jail, you know, thought of that. That's a lot of leverage. You know.
I can't explain it, but you're right. I was definitely looking at serious consequences. No question.
Right. So after this point in time, are you doing stand-up at this point or at this point or not yet?
I'd always dabbled with stand-up, but improv was my core thing. But, you know, yeah. I liked the idea of doing solo stuff. I was just more interested in more scene stuff. But I'd always enjoyed it. I'd always done it. I did it in Kansas City in high school. I'd always messed around. Anything close to that has anything to do with comedy has always been of interest to me. You know?
Okay. So we segue now into how much longer, this is the early to mid 90s around there.
Yeah.
How then was a big needle mover for you? Was it the Geico commercial or what happens in between this point and that?
Yeah, I got sober and I had worked before, you know, I'd worked on some Noah Baumbach movies and I had done some ghostwriting for him. So I'd kind of learned about writing and I'd been on a few TV shows. I'd been on, you know, Friends and Lois and Clark, you know, little things like that. And so I was kind of making my way. I'd done a show called News Weasels on E, which was, oh my God.
That sounds familiar.
Oh God. That. It was a show. And I was writing on that as well. And so I had enough going to kind of pay my bills, but really once I got sober, I was in a lot of pain because I wasn't doing any, I wasn't going into any programs or I was in therapy kind of, but yeah. didn't really have the money for that per se. But then I got on a show called Jesse, which was Christina Applegate starred in it. It was on NBC. It was between Friends and Frasier, which, you know, my joke was always you could run black screen between Friends and Frasier and get great ratings.
Right.
But she was great and it paid really well. And that gave me health insurance. And that
were you acting in that?
Yeah, I played her brother. It was a great part.
She's a craftsman. It must have been nice to play tennis with her.
Oh my God. Yeah. She's an amazing person and still is. And is just, I admire her very much, especially what she's going through now. But, you know, she was just this total pro, sweet person. The show itself, you know, was problematic, just ill-conceived, but she was amazing. And I liked everybody I worked with, but most importantly, really, to be honest with you, is I finally made a lot of money. And I paid off all my debt. I paid off my Northwestern student because, you know, I didn't come from any money. So I was carrying a lot of debt and I got health insurance and was able to get into therapy, real therapy. And that led me to my therapist really got me into sort of, you know, working on a program to address my drug and alcoholism. And and medication for my depression. And that really was what kind of finally made, I don't know, just took the edge off enough for me to kind of enjoy myself a little bit and enjoy making things again. And so that, and then the Geico caveman came and
I want to just note on something. That's a sign of intelligence and higher consciousness. Once you started making money, that's when you said, I'm going to invest in myself. Maybe get a therapist. Cause you were, you've been sober at this point, but you knew you wanted to grow. I did the same thing. When I started making money is when I really started doubling down on more personal development. Cause I was heavily in personal development, you know, in my late 20s. And when I really started to make money is when I said, that's when I'm going to spend more money on improving myself.
Yeah. And I had to. I mean, look, I was sober, but it had gotten worse because I had stopped drinking and using. But I was using drinking and using. I didn't know it at the time, but I was using that to medicate this hole in me, this sort of selfish, self-centered, self-hatred hole. And the alcohol and drugs had been removed, but the hole was still there. And so now things had actually gotten worse. I was more unhappy because I didn't even have the medication anymore. So I was this really unpleasant human being. I was stone cold sober, but I was a total asshole. So, yeah. So then getting into therapy and finally learning, you know, that, you know, kind of a spiritual component start and these kinds of things of leading a more authentic, you know, life, that really, that's where the change really started to come. And that's when my career started to really, you know, go the way I had always hoped, which was being a creative force. Yes, performing in it, but also being a force behind what I wanted to present to people, you know, comedically.
So this segues into the Geico commercial. And the reason why that was such a, people will say it's a commercial. There, you know, first of all, I don't watch much television shows, but I tell you, you know, that was so iconic to me because first of all, I think that really worked. And I'm not just kissing your ass here. I think it really worked because of the comedic timing and of course the writing of the commercial of the spot itself, but that really hit big. And there's a couple things that I'm sitting in your shoes thinking, well, one that probably did that pay better than let's say Jesse and the other things to where,
oh my God. Yes. The Geico caveman bought me my house.
Right.
I mean, it was 20. I did over 25 national spots. And this was back when commercials paid. You know, now commercials are more often than not non-union. They're buyouts. You know, people aren't really watching broadcasts anymore. This was way before all of that. This was when it was like, you know, you got a spot. If you got one national spot, that could set you for 6 months, you know, back then. And here I've got 25 and they keep running. It was insane. It was insane.
And for people that don't know, you know what we're talking about, huge commercial campaign for the Geico insurance. But this was like something was very special about this spot. It had a lot of meat to it. And the thing that amazes me, because I've never talked to you before until today, is that the personality of the character in that commercial that you play and who you are from talking to you for the past 20 minutes, whatever, is so different. You know, so where did that character, you know, how did you make that? What was the impetus? What was told to you? What did you create on your own?
So I got the audition. I didn't know any, you know, when commercial auditions are very strange, you usually get the audition the day before. You rarely see any lines. So you just kind of show up at these weird places with big lobbies, and they have doors all around the perimeter, and each door is a commercial auditioning actors. That's the best way I can describe it. And you go in and you do lots of them. It's a numbers game. So there's not a lot of thought put into it. There's not a lot of time to prepare. You just do it and hope you get it, right? Mm-hmm. So I got this thing. It was for Geico. And I show up. It says caveman. I'm like, what? And I'm trying to figure it out. And it kind of this metrosexual character. And I go in and I do the lines, and then they say, hey, do you improvise, right? And I said, yeah. And they said, why don't you improvise? And then, you know, I'm on my turf, and I just improvised, and they loved it. And so I think that's how I got it. Now, they hired basically three guys. One was like the angry one. One was the kind of happy-go-lucky guy, which was me. And then a third one. And my friends Jeff and Ben played those. And the three of us did all these spots. And Jeff and I did the most spots for sure. But it was, you know, it was a commercial, you know, it's not that hard, you know, it's so fast, but they let me improvise at the end of every take. And a lot of those lines that I improvised at the end were the ones that ended up making the cut. And that made it so fun for me, you know, and there's something about doing commercials where, you know, you're not curing cancer. You know, everybody is like, look, bottom line is we're selling car insurance here. We're not, you know, we're not going for an Oscar. And so there's something about that makes it, I don't know, it just takes the stakes off, and everybody kind of comes family, and it's just very comfortable, you know, and you kind of just do your job and go home, and everybody's enjoys themselves.
I always try to overanalyze, but I was trying to, there's like this deeper, like these characters, and it's not like you, to where they're kind of like, first of all, your voices seem like, you know, your voice seems lower in the Geico commercial than it is now. What were the choices that you chose at the time? Do you remember? It's like, oh, this character should have a lower voice, or they're kind of like, you know, their motive is this, to act like this, or do you remember? Cause it was a very distinct, you're bubbly. Yeah. I'm talking to you. Yeah. I'm like, you're like, yeah, yeah. But that character's not like that. It's kind of right. Like, you know, they're a little defensive, you know,
yeah.
They're funny.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, so much of it, and I, you know, not to, you know, throw myself under the bus, but I got to tell you, so much of it had to do with the makeup. I mean, I would joke around that you could throw that stuff on anybody. And as long as they did a decent job, they'd be fine. I mean, they did do that later, and they still do. They have new guys that they throw it on, and it's not as good. So maybe we did have something to do with it. But
well, we were just talking in the pregame, just so everybody knows, they made a movie, they made a show.
A TV show.
This mm-hmm. whole campaign, this Geico mm-hmm. commercial campaign, became a TV show, and it didn't mm-hmm. do so well.
No, it didn't. And I don't know exactly why, but they didn't hire any of the original cavemen from the commercial campaign. So, you know, the easy response is,
why didn't they do that?
I couldn't do it. I was doing a show on TBS called 10 Items or Less by that point. And it was a show that I had created and starred in. So I was locked down. I couldn't do another show. I could guest star. Like, I think my contract allowed 3 guest stars a season. So I could guest on Caveman, but I couldn't be a regular on it. Nice. So I don't know why Jeff and Ben didn't get it. You know, it's easy to say, well, they should have hired those guys. And, but you know, who knows, man? I mean, you know, getting a show on the air is so hard. Who knows what they went through, but yeah, it didn't connect it. Once it got to 22 minutes, and they had talent too on that show. So I don't know why, but America didn't like it. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't, you know, it's so weird. It was kind of like people were angry by that show too, for some reason. It's same way they were angry with like New Coke. I was like, yeah. I'm like, why? I once again, I'm not a TV guy, I'm more of a film guy, but I was like, why are people not liking this? This is hilarious to me. I thought that was going to be a funny show. Maybe with to me, it could have been the writing, because I'm like, this could be like, you know, there could be a lot of like, you know, deeper, funny messages in this. And hey, look, Seinfeld was a show about nothing. So why couldn't this be true. Something that was, you know, interesting, but I don't know. But so back to you though, you do a staggering amount of spots. I mean, that's like flow type, you know, with territory with 20,
oh my God,
25 episodes of the spots of these shows.
Oh yeah.
Days for Your House, you know, and then some probably. And still, do they show that still? I'm just curious. Is it still?
It's still, they every now and then they rerun old ones. So every now and then I'll get a check, and they've kind of thrown a few ones out there, but it's still a thing somehow. I was just recently, I did an episode of I Can See Your Voice, which is a game show on Fox Network, where, you know, they have different contestants lip sync, or you try to decide if they're lip syncing or really singing. It's, I don't know. I'd never seen it before, but it gets pretty good numbers. And they had asked, they wanted the Geico caveman to be on it. And so they called me and, you know, it was fun. I, you know, cause you get to be friends with the, you spend so much time with the makeup guys that you, you know, we've all had kids now, you know, we all know each other. So that was great. And, you know, it was fun. Yeah. Got to go on, sing a song.
Awesome. The career continues. You start doing, you get to produce your own thing. You know, yeah. You're doing that.
Yeah.
Where does your journey take you with that? And then from there?
Well, when I came out to LA, I'd always, my dream was to figure out a way to use improv on TV, but tell a narrative, have a story, a strong story, but still use improv to generate the dialogue, you know, nobody was interested. I did end up getting a pilot presentation deal at Fox, that didn't go forward, but I used multicam to shoot it on location, which was kind of new, that idea of so that you could get the full, all the angles at once, like you would in a sitcom. Mm-hmm. And so I started to kind of learn like how I wanted to do it. And then I met Nancy Hauer, who was just incredible, talented director. And she asked me to come do a part on a super low budget film that she was doing and let me improvise. And we kind of fell in love with each other. And we ended up doing a super low budget film called Memron, which made fun of the Enron scandal at the time. That's how long ago this was. Yeah. And it won Slamdance, the film festival. And that kind of, I had sold a script by then to David Schwimmer's company. So I had enough, you know, legitimacy to take a pitch in. And we wanted to pitch a TV show and a workplace show. And the grocery store strike was happening at the time in LA. And we were like, wait, why don't we do a show set in a grocery store? And we went in and pitched it to Sony. They bought it in the room. You know,
when does that happen?
I don't know.
And, Hogan's Heroes, maybe.
Yeah. Exactly. And we went and then we shot a pilot, shot it totally our style, where it was scripted, but none of the dialogue was scripted. So it was very detailed script, but no dialogue. We would never show the scripts to the actors. I mean, I knew it because I'd written them, but the other actors never saw the script. So they would just show up. We'd kind of tell them, you know, the gist and then start improvising. And we cut that into a pilot and sold it to TBS and it ran for 3 seasons. So, you know, suddenly I'm show running. You know, I'm starring and writing all the episodes of my own show, which was like, you know, my ultimate dream. You know, it was incredible.
Amazing. And then
how
does that segue into, I mean, I want to get into some of the other things that you did after that.
Yeah.
But like, how does that segue into, you've done like a one-man show or something like that? Or like, how does that work? How does that progress to that?
Okay, it was kind of, let's see. Yeah, I think it was simultaneous at that time that I had started to doing work on myself in the sober sort of sphere and had started writing a lot about myself. That was part of the, you know, sort of the work that I was doing in that arena. And it was funny. It was dark as hell, but it was funny. And I had no problem sort of talking about like getting arrested and all of those things. And I kind of really wanted to do a solo show, but I hated solo shows.
One man shows that it's not comedy, but it's also a little bit of drama in there. You don't like those?
Well, I just,
John Leguizamo, no good.
Well, I liked him for sure. Yeah. But there were so many that I had seen in LA that were just seemed to me like very precious, very, selfish, like just self-obsessed.
Because they're doing it for wrong reasons. I know what you're talking about. It's like you're doing this show to promote yourself, to where you need to do the show for the people that you're serving, the people that are going to see it, and you're spilling your guts at their expense to give something that's truly raw and entertaining, not for yourself, but for them. Isn't
exactly
that true?
That's okay. Exactly. You nailed it. And okay. And I was talking to a friend of mine, an old, very old friend from Kansas, who was a director. And I was telling him this problem, like, I'd like to do it, but I don't know how to do it without looking like a or participating in that. Mm-hmm. And he came up with this idea. His name's John McCray, one of my oldest friends, like from 14. And he said, why don't we do it like a lecture? As if you're an old school Buckminster Fuller. If you've ever heard of Buckminster Fuller, he was this crazy character from the 50s who would do these, amongst other things, do these like 8-hour lectures. And he was really nerdy, kind of like my dad, wore a suit, you know, had a chalkboard, but would be talking about these crazy things. And so we called it a series of comedic lectures by John Lear, and we wrote 6 of them. And each one had its own thesis. So it was almost, it was the conceit is that I'm giving a lecture as if you're a college class, but really it's an excuse to tell all of these crazy stories. So I'll give you an example. One of them that was the most popular was called Bigfoot, the Donner Party, and My Arrest. And I would do a lecture where I would compare 3 men, Grover S. Krantz, who was this PhD who kind of threw his career away because he was certain that Bigfoot existed. George Donner, who was in the Donner family, you know, who got caught in the snow in the 1800s and end up eating each other to stay alive. And then me getting arrested. And I talked about how all 3 of these men made a series of bad mistakes. Right. And so that's sort of the lecture, right? But really what it is it ends up, I talk about my arrest and, you know, what it means to sort of bottom out as a result of your idiocy. And so people loved it. They loved it.
Instead of the regular old format, starting from the beginning of your story and changing the set background and then this happened and that happened. So exactly. You kind of added a little vehicle to it.
Exactly. And it made it a little bit more, people were able to devour it, you know, in a way where it wasn't like theater. And I ended up taking it off Broadway, and it was a blast. I mean, it was just awesome. Awesome. Yeah. Awesome.
So you went to New York to do that.
Went to New York. Yeah.
And where did it show? What theater did you show it at?
The Zipper Theater. It's on the lower. Let's see. It was in the 30s on the West Side.
Just, I think there were awesome. Wooster players. William Defoe's place. Is that where it's near?
Yes. It was. Yes. Near that. Yeah. Nicely done. the Wooster.
It's near there, right?
Yes, it is. Right. And it, it was just so great. But doing it in LA was great too. I did it in Santa Monica at the Powerhouse Theater, which is
great. And that's great because it's two totally different vibes to do a one man show, though.
Yeah.
You know, LA, you know, like maybe there'll be an A or maybe there'll be somebody here where I can get a job. You know, New York is like, you're kind of thinking about that a little bit less, but you're like, this is New York. I'm expanding my instrument here.
Exactly.
This is nitty gritty, you know, Lower East Side.
People are coming to be entertained or be provoked, you know, and in LA, they tend to have multiple agendas.
In some way, it's almost, and I'm asking, you know, is it, because I've never done a one-man show in New York, but it's almost like, you know, if you went off base a little bit and it didn't totally get a laugh, but if it was raw, New York would accept it more than LA. Cause LA is like, we want to see laughs and results. It's where New York is like, what's the deeper meaning? Is it profound? If it's profound, we like that too.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And also I think New York allowed for a lot more improvisation. Cause I would change the shows all the time. And I think New York audiences seemed more open to that. You know, they were, you know, just theater people, you know, so they just wanted to find the moment, you know, and whereas LA is a little bit more like, let's script it and get the moment and sell shampoo.
Right. So you've had a nice, busy career. You're like, but it's like, you know, somebody's like, well, what? It's not like a household name, but I had this at my first acting teacher. I was like, just out of high school. And I think his name is John Medici. And he's like, look, he's like, I've been in like, and he named a lot of movies and a lot of shows. And he's like, I made a really great career and I'm still am. And it's busy. And it's like, but it's not like a Marlon Brando, But you know what? You could, you know, he was a working guy and you've been a working guy.
Yeah.
So where does this go from at this point to where you are now? What were some of the highlights and where are you at today?
Well, the 10 items or less lasted 3 seasons. And after that, we ended up doing, multiple pilots that didn't go, Comedy Central, HBO, NBC, you know, and of course you get paid for all of those jobs, but they never hit the airwaves. And then we finally sold a show to Sony, who had a new portal called Crackle. And Crackle, it's still around. Yeah. And they asked us if we would do a short, a limited series for Crackle. And we had this idea of doing a show set in a prison. This is before Orange is the New Black, called Jailbait. And definitely rated R version of our work. And so we did that. And then that at the same time, 10 Items or Less had started getting a big following on a network called Hulu that was new. Yeah. And Hulu called us in and said, would you guys like to develop a show for us? And we, I had been fascinated with the Donner Party, as I told you, and I had been trying to convince my partner to.
Why are you fascinated with the Donner Party?
It's just so dark. It's just so dark that I feel that things that are so dark, the only way to look at them is through comedy, because they're just beyond dark. I feel like that's where comedy is. It can really help the human experience.
I feel the same way about nuclear war.
Right.
It's like as dark as you can get.
It's dark, but what are you going to do with that? You at some point you have to laugh. And I think, and so anyway, but she was not into the Donner Party at all, but that kind of morphed into a Western. And then we ended up selling this show to Hulu called Quick Draw, which was a improvised comedic Western that's still playing. It went 2 seasons. And so now I'm doing the same thing. I'm developing a new show with Village Roadshow, and it's going to be that sort of hybrid improvised style. It's an entirely different arena, but it's what I love to do, you know, and I work with the same crew and, you know, the same, I've formed a company called Triple Threat Media, which is basically the crew of people I've worked with all these years. And we make stuff, you know,
You know, the fact that you kept on, you know, going, you hit kind of a critical mass point where, you know, your time plus effort plus connections plus everything is created probable success that helps you to continue forward, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it, you know, it's for me, it's all about team. This is a collaborative art form. And I remember I had a moment on 10 Items or Less. I was the showrunner. I didn't even know what that meant, but I'm in charge, right? I, along with my partner, we are in charge of delivering episodes on time and on budget quality. You know, it's a big job. It's a lot of money was involved, millions of dollars. And, you know, and I thought that the crew's job, here's this crew of like 150 people, and I thought their job was to execute my vision. I thought I had this vision and their job is to execute that vision. And I quickly realized that that was bullshit and that my job was to create a content that takes advantage of what they all do best. So instead of my job is to find out what my crew does best and exploit that in a way that makes the best possible content. And that was a huge shift for me, was trying to create content that utilized my crew and all the people. And I mean, everybody, Transpo, everybody. What do they do best? And how can I bring that into what we're doing? And that really changed my life.
Right. Because otherwise you're trying to put a square peg in a round hole kind of a little bit, because it's like, no, this is not what they do best. You know, it might as well just, you know, walk with each other rather than just forcing them to, you know, to do what I want them to do. Or
Yeah, because people in this business aren't really doing it for the money. I mean, if you are, you're kind of crazy, because the chances of making money in this business, you know, it's the lotto. But I think people are in this business because they want to make stuff. They want to be in that experience on the set where you're just using all of your problem solving skills and creativity to make something that will hopefully entertain people. Yeah. And once you, the more you allow the people who work on your project the rope to be able to do that, then they'll work. It's just good business. I mean, they'll work their butts off. Everybody will be happier. People will be, you know, go beyond the minimum. Yeah.
And I can go for any business, anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's the long game? What's the long game for you?
Yeah.
What's the long term? Oh, what's the 30,000 foot view of where you want to go, 5 to 10, you know, do you plan that far ahead? tell us, you know, what it looks like.
I now have a production company that I'm along with three partners, and they have their own, like they're both Emmy winners, and they have, so that's really fascinating to me. I've kind of, as I've gotten older, I've been brought on to projects as a consultant to help other newer people kind of do their thing, but needing some, you know, someone to sort of mentor them or show them the mistakes that I made so that they don't make it. And I love that. That's been really fun, is to watch other people and kind of just give away everything I've learned. I've done some teaching lately that has been, I thought I would hate it, and I'm surprised to say I don't, but my core is I still just want to make movies, TV shows. I love being on a set, and I'll do anything I can to do that. You know,
you figure out a way to connect the dots and continue to have a nice steady as she goes career.
Yeah.
That sounds wonderful to me. And it's such an industry where it's really hard to get, you know, you hop on one stone, you're like, I think I can glide this way, where, you know, just keep on going up. And a lot of people just don't have a career after that. They're like, that was it, you know, to where you were able to, like, you know, the next thing and segue to the next thing and really sustain. And I think that's great.
Yeah. I think my sensibility has a niche audience. I've done stuff that's very pop and big, but I think at my core, I'm the kind of person who, you know, it's so funny. I run into people who have seen, you know, some of the stuff I've made, and, you know, I had an experience when I was on Jesse, you know, and it was a big, you know, it was millions of people saw me, and I hosted a show called I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here on ABC, you know, these big kind of network experiences. And you run into people who recognize you from that, and it's not a pleasant experience, you know, because they're intense, you know, and they come at you kind of wild eyed, and they know you, but you don't know them. It's very, I can see why it freaks people out. My whole thing is like, well, dude, you chose this. This is part of the job, and be cool. But still, it is weird. It's very artificial. But when I run into people who have seen my work, like Quick Draw or 10 Items or some of my other Jailbait or some of my other stuff, it's like we're friends, you know, because we know that it's not for everybody. And any fan of those shows is a friend of mine, you know, and that's sort of the way I treat them. So
the riches are in the niches, and you create a raving fans because you gave them that little piece that they own. And somebody in the entertainment industry once told me some wise information. He says, when you make, you know, your art, you know, you're making it, you're writing it. If you're making a movie, you're writing it, it's yours. And then once you put it out there, it's not yours anymore. Theirs. It's everybody else's too. Yeah. And they have a piece of ownership of that. That's their thing too. And that's what you created, especially when you do a niche.
I got off stage doing improv in a club in Chicago, and my dad was there. He had seen the show, and I thought it sucked. And I got off and I was like, oh, that sucked. And my dad said, wait, I liked it. And I paid $8 to see it. So I'm right and you're wrong.
Right.
And he was right. He was absolutely right. It was a huge lesson. It's not up to me to decide. It's up to them.
You know, here's a healthy way to end this. And that, not that you've ever had a problem with this, because you've had the opposite. But, you know, when you own your own shit as an artist, you know, and you're very zen-like about, hey, look, man, I put it out there and I'm going to walk away from this just, you know, learning from it, but be happy with what I just did, no matter what, and own it and be okay. People notice that. And they're like, because if you're apologetic about some shit or you're like, ah, that sucked. It's like, yeah, nah, I don't want to listen to that guy, you know, but people that are, you know, just own it, you know, it's a very, it's a great place to be. I think as you inherently get older, that's what you inherently think. The younger, anybody younger listening is like the fastest you can get from point A to point Z to that of confidence and just who gives a shit.
Yeah.
Like you're onto something. And
yeah.
Thank you for sharing this.
Peace of mind, man. Peace of mind.
Yeah.
It's yeah.
And you know, I know it's not easy to talk about, but you do talk about it often. It was about I love your story about the valley that you took. I like, sounds funny, but only people that listen to this, you know, podcast know it's like, I like your, I like the dip that you took because I think it definitely helped you.
Absolutely.
You know? And that's a common algorithm with a lot of people.
Yeah, it is. At the time you think it's the worst thing that ever happened to you. And then later you think it's the best thing that ever happened to you. Right. And it's a trip, but it's true.
And probably during that one man show, was probably some of the highlights of those.
It was. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah.
Man. John Lear, thank you so much for sharing.
Oh man, a pleasure, Michael. This was great. It was great meeting you. And, I'm glad we have some friends in common, and, I'm sure we'll run into each other at the Ralph's or something.
Ralph's Market right over there. And the Sherman Oaks Ralph is the one I used to go to all the time.
All right. All right. Oh yeah. You're in Texas now.
I'm in Georgetown, Texas, but I do miss Ralph's.
Well, I'm down in the Austin area. So hopefully we can run into each other.
Well, we'll be keeping in touch. You know, everybody that's on the podcast, we have we have a plan for you for the next podcast. So we'll talk about that in the post game, but thank you for sharing today.
Thank you. Thanks for being here.
Pleasure.
That was actor, writer, and producer John Lear. Got a fun little quote for you, John. Here it goes. Hollywood is a factory. You have to realize that you're working in a factory and you're part of the mechanism. If you break down, you'll be replaced. Mel Gibson, thank you for joining us, and I look forward to hanging out with you all in the next episode. All right. Have you guys been to longshotleaders.com? That's where you can check out all of the guests and the bios and the backgrounds and more. Also, if you haven't done so already, subscribe to the podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what we do, give us a good rating. Tell your family and friends to come by and listen. It's going to make you feel nice and toasty inside. Every week we'll be delivering knowledge, creativity, inspiration, exasperation, perspiration. If it ends with a shun, basically you're going to find it here. All right. Thank you for joining us. And in the great words of Bill Murray in the movie Caddyshack, friends for life, I say.